Well, thanks to movies like Pirates of the Caribbean, our opinions of pirates, I think, has probably softened a little bit. But I tell you what, back in 1801, when Thomas Jefferson became president, they were very real, and they were a big problem for the newly formed United States of America. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Brian Kilmeade is with us today. He co-hosts Fox News Channel's morning show, Fox and Friends, hosts the daily national radio show, Kilmeade and Friends. He and Don Yeager co-authored the New York Times bestseller, George Washington's Secret Six. And their latest book is Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, the forgotten war that changed American history. You may have some questions about this forgotten war, and I hope you'll join in. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Brian Kilmeade, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Larry, thanks for the build-up. So your audience should know that these guys are the same Islamic terrorists back then that we're dealing with today, the ISIS and Al-Qaeda mindset. So as much as people want to say outlaws, yeah, they were outlaws, but they, again, bastardized the Quran to attack us.
I tell you what, I often on this show, I deal with so many topics that I'm often, I have to admit that I'm ignorant about topics. And this one, I don't remember reading anything about this in my history classes. I wonder why this war has kind of been left out of our U.S. history classes.
Yeah, number one, you know, when we talked to the historians at the Jefferson Library, at the Marine Museum, they kind of laughed when we showed up, and they said, I know, ever since 9/11, we used to be the loneliest guys in the Jefferson Library, but since 9/11, people more and more are knocking at our doors, and then up comes ISIS, and they're doing it again, and then comes Libya operation and the problems we've had since, and they're coming again. So we thought that there would be unexplored areas in this region. We never thought that we could do the definitive biography on Jefferson. I feel like that's been done by people a lot smarter than us. But I do feel as though if we brought up this one area that can relate to everyday Americans that we dealt with today, that you could take pride in the way our third president dealt with it, that there would be some interest, and there was. And that's why it's out on paperback now.
Yeah, I tell you what, it is a crackling adventure. I really
thank you.
Enjoyed it, as did Jill Nadeau, my producer. We both thought, boy, what an adventure. Well, let's talk about the book and about the time a little bit after, independence from Great Britain. What were the biggest threats we faced?
I mean, basically, we thought that we were going to have another war with Britain, and we knew there was going to be a rematch. We just had to put it off as long as possible. They weren't accepting the verdict. Then we had some brush-ups with France, our first big ally, and Adams thought that was the main problem. Now, we had no president, and we had no constitution. We just wanted to be able to export our goods and start building up a getting out of war debt. And next thing you know, as we go through the coast of North Africa, we start getting attacked. And our ships get terrorized, and our cargo gets plundered, and our guys take hostage, and they're told if we want to get them back, you know, either they convert, which they didn't, from Christianity to Islam, or we had to pay a lot of money. Yeah. So that's when Jefferson, who was a diplomat in France, and Adams, who was a diplomat in England, said, "Let's go find the ambassador to." And these countries are Tunisia, Algeria, they are Morocco. And, of course, Tripoli, which we now know as Libya. So we went and found the Tripoli ambassador. We said, listen, I think you guys got us mixed up with somebody. We don't have a problem with you. We're not England. We're not Spain. We're not France. We're this new country. They go, yeah, we're going to charge you more. And after having some productive conversations, they said, it's going to be essentially you got to pay us tribute. And you got to give us gifts. You got to pay me off, which is basically a bribe. And you got to do it as long as you want to use the Mediterranean. And at first we said, you know, Adam says we got to pay. And Jefferson says, we can't. The whole world's watching. If we look like patsies, we're going to be attacked nonstop by bigger powers. But since we didn't have a serviceable navy, we paid. When George Washington got in office, he said, we're going to have to ask Jefferson to do a study. He said, we got to get a navy going, but I'm going to have to pay too and get our guys out. And America was horrified by the accounts of what it was like. And then when Washington was done, we had a navy. Adam says, I'm not going to use it. These guys are crazy. We're going to have to fight them forever. But when Jefferson took over, he said, I'm not paying them, and I know they're going to declare war on us, and then we're going to have a chance to stand up for ourselves. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Was this a simple extortion, or was it would you think of it as a form of terrorism?
Absolutely both. It was extortion. It was terror. Money would buy yourself some passage on international waters, which is fundamentally illegal even then. And using, you know, the basic ambassador, as we put in the book, it was told John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, it says the Quran, we're allowed to do this unless you want to convert or unless you want to pay. And they would cite passages in the Quran. Now, Jefferson read the Quran. Said, no, it doesn't say that. But it was not easy to rationalize back then either. And next thing you know, we had our first challenge. In the beginning, we screwed up. We had a bad blockade. We learned to communicate better. We rotated admirals and captains. And we finally did it right. But it wasn't until we put a land war together, going from Egypt with the deposed leader 500 miles to take off Derna, which is the main city off Tripoli, until they realized we meant business and we were able to get our guys back. But in the paperback, we put an addendum to that.
Yeah, it's a nice addendum, by the way. Tommy in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Tommy, thanks for calling.
Hey, no problem. Hey, Brian, I just want to applaud you for coming into the mecca of liberalism on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
You're going to be inundated, Brian, with a bunch of mad callers, the fact that you're on here, but I think you're an awesome guy. You've done a great job at Fox and Friends, and I applaud you for coming on this radio station today. Hang in there and keep strong, okay, man?
Well, I tell you what, I just think this is a story that Americans can rally around and take pride in, not liberals or liberal Democrats or conservative Republicans, but thank you.
Yeah, I think this is a story. I don't care what your persuasion is. You can you can really learn a lot from this whole story. I tell you, let's go a little deeper into what the pirates were doing to the U.S. ship. What happened when the American ships were taken by the pirates?
What type of American ships? They were merchant ships. They had no way of protecting themselves. So we provided security with six frigates that were quicker, smoother, with this great wood that we had, only indigenous to America and our burgeoning country. And we're able to really learn how to communicate on the open seas, how to fight, engage an enemy that truly wanted to board you, not destroy you, wanted to take you whole. And it really gave us a dry run against the British and got our Navy formidable, because by, you know, a few years later, we'd be in the War of 1812. Yeah. And if we did not have some coordination and some experience, we would have gotten pretty much annihilated in a war that got off to a horrendous start. But, man, we were pretty formidable at sea with the world's only naval power.
And that's this whole business, the war with Tripoli, was the start of the Marine Corps. You know, I was thinking about the Marine Corps hymn to the shores of Tripoli, and I just never thought much about it.
I mean, just picture this. There's a few people that when you close the book, you're going to be familiar with, but you don't know now. Stephen Decatur, James Decatur. You're going to think about Ambassador O'Brien. You're going to think about Edward Preble, the real father of our first Navy. And you're going to think of the man's man, William Eaton, a brilliant military mind, fearless, with an iron jaw, who was able to go into Egypt, find the deposed leader, hire a bunch of mercenaries, all different ways and backgrounds, including Muslims, and take a handful of Marines, mm-hmm. go 500 miles without a map through the desert and take a standing city in about 3 hours. And he did it. This is America's first land war. And they say from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And it's really Presley O'Bannon and other Marines that led this charge and started the mystery and the legacy of our great Marines that they are so proud of. And the Marines listening right now know this story backwards and forwards. Even though William Eaton was an Army guy, Presley O'Bannon was the highest ranking Marine.
And, you know, to me, it was really interesting. In this day and age, when you just get on your cell phone and call somebody up, back then, Jefferson had to deal with long waits to learn about things that were happening. I mean, there were some pretty tough experiences with our ships getting grounded, and one of the poor leaders wound up, I forget his name now, but he wound up kind of losing a couple of ships.
Yeah, I mean, you had Captain Barron, who was more into touring around and meeting with other capitals down there and saying, hey, look at the size of my Navy. We're having a great time. I'm at Gibraltar, hanging out at the port. Yeah, we're in this blockade. It's not too exciting. Really? When this got back to Jefferson, because communication was so terrible and Twitter was always down, who would have thought? When this got back, he fired him on the spot. Much like, you know, you saw FDR do and Truman do later on. It doesn't mean that every president's got to be happy with every leader. A good leader rotates until he gets the right guy. Now, we lost one ship, the USS Philadelphia, by William Bainbridge. He ran aground with this beautiful ship because, of course, we didn't know the bottom of the water like they did the ports. And this brand new ship, instead of trying to get out or waiting for the tide to come up, he threw everything overboard, hoping to lift the boat out of the water and be able to free himself. Instead, he disarmed himself. They couldn't believe how stupid he was with the move, so they took the ship intact. And it took Stephen Decatur and the first edition of what we now know as the Navy SEALs to try to take the ship back. When he couldn't, he blew it up, preventing them from using the USS Philadelphia against us. It was considered one of the finest expeditions of its day. That was a quote from a leading admiral in the British Navy, Lord Nelson.
And I think the whole story of how they did that was really fascinating. You could make a great movie out of this.
We're moving on that, and we hope to have an announcement pretty soon. I mean, people get nervous. They see ships and period pieces, and they go, oh, my goodness, how much is going to cost? But I just think we could do it affordably, and I think America needs to see the story. They need to understand where we came from to understand where we're at today. And I think we found that story with George Washington's Secret Six, with our spy ring. And I think, again, we found these unsung heroes who were nestled between the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. And by the way, the philosophy in which we're still being attacked with today.
What was, go into a little details, just give our listeners an idea of what happened in that event, getting rid of that ship, blowing that ship up.
The USS Philadelphia?
Yeah.
You had a group of hand-selected operators, fearless Americans, who were aboard one of the six Navy frigates who were providing the blockade for the shores of Tripoli in order to suffocate their economy. Then we started pounding their shore, and we started harassing their ships and taking their ships captive, cutting off their masts, and just sending them into sea. So we started really asserting ourselves. But then the USS Philadelphia was after one of the small pirate ships and ran aground. When that ran aground, they took it over as a big passage. They thought Allah sent them this ship. So it was up to us to schedule an undercover special operations operation. And Stephen Decatur scripted it out. They dressed it like people of that region, so Arabic, Muslims, people of Arab descent. And they boarded the ship in the middle of the night. And they took the ship fully armed. They got it totally on board. They overcame the crew, killed countless members on the USS Philadelphia. And when they realized they couldn't free it and sail it, they put up explosives everywhere. And they jumped into their ships and blew it up just as they were getting away. It was an operation we'd have trouble pulling off today, an operation they pulled off flawlessly then. That became the myth of Stephen Decatur. It wasn't a myth, it was a fact. The guy fought in four wars, was fearless, was unbelievably heroic, and was able to win hand-to-hand combat operations, schedule major operations, and actually be a hero against the British in 1812, against France in the mini war that we had with them. And then, of course, and was able to come back. And basically, America turned around and gave Stephen Decatur cash. They said, you're a hero. We don't have anything for you. Can we just give you cash? And he bought a house that still stands today called the Decatur House. And what I did on BrianKilmeade.com, I did a tour of his house. Believe it or not,
cool.
Stephen Decatur ended up dying in a duel once back in America. This guy was en route to becoming president. But unfortunately, he couldn't back down from a challenge, and he took a bullet in the stomach and bled to death in his own foyer.
Oh, man, what a story. Brian Kilmeade, our guest today, he is the co-author of the book Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Or if you want to post on our Facebook page, Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11:45 today, we're going to be talking about another president, Ulysses S. Grant. The author of the new book, American Ulysses, will be with us, and I hope you can stay around for that as well. In the meantime, talking with Brian Kilmeade, who, along with Dan Yeager, wrote Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, the forgotten war that changed American history. As I said in the beginning, I knew nothing about this particular war. I learned a lot, and in the meantime, I also really enjoyed it. It's quite an adventure story with some people who were fearless, frankly, and did a lot of wonderful things for the United States during this time. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And let's go back to that communication issue. You know, how people were able to operate, Brian, at this time when it would sometimes take months to get a response was amazing to me.
You know what it also allowed? It is amazing. And you know, the fact that people are getting mail on these ships, the fact that, you know, we did not know that Tripoli declared war on us. We assumed they did. So Jefferson sent some ships over there to Gibraltar, and they said, basically, keep your ear to the ground. Find out what country declared war on us, you know, and why. And sure enough, the word came out of Gibraltar that it was Tripoli. So they go, okay, fine. And they had their demands, and we said, we're not going to go by their demands, and we set up their ships. And it was hard enough to communicate between ships in order to coordinate. Now, think about this. If you are a military leader, you love the lack of communication because you have this thing called an objective. You have a mission, and there's no drone overhead describing what you're doing and trying to move you around according to some diplomatic some diplomatic benefit. You're able to go get an objective, get a mission, and tell us how you did. Now, we didn't find out. Jefferson didn't get word that the USS Philadelphia was even taken until it was already taken back and blown up. So that was relatively good. I mean, who knows what would have happened with the American public if they knew this long, drawn-out blockade has yielded now our guys. By the way, 303 of our guys were taken hostage and put through all types of tortures as they were going through 16 hours hard labor with very little clothing, working menial, horrific jobs while they were taken captive, too. If that word got back to America, there would have been all types of pressure quickly on Jefferson to pull the plug on this operation. Why do we want to do this? Because the rest of the world wasn't doing it. They were writing the checks. Why is he doing it? But instead, they were able to go through the ups and downs, find a way to get it done.
Yeah, it was really amazing. So they were just sort of, in some senses, they were acting as, well, the government. I mean, they were acting without orders. They had general orders from above, but as you say, the specifics, they were able to pretty much do on their own, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad.
Yeah. I mean, would Jefferson like to have been on some of these decisions? Perhaps. But for example, we couldn't get, William Eaton was an ambassador to Tunisia. And he knew that these pirates were all bluster. He knew they could be taken. And he wanted us to stand up to them. And he said that the people there were more oppressed than you could even possibly imagine. They didn't want any part of this government, but they had no, they didn't know anything different. And he said, you guys can take these guys, stand up to the bully, take them on. And when Jefferson finally did do the job, he said, okay, give me some money, give me some guys, let's get a land war together. And Jefferson said, are you crazy? Fight a land war in the desert? No way. Well, after 2 years of this blockade, he said, bring William Eaton in here. We got to amend our battle plan a little bit. And he basically said to Gallatin, the Treasury Secretary, get him 1,000 muskets, get him some money, let him get an army, but if anything happens, I knew nothing about it. So we had our first clandestine operation to overthrow a sitting government and put somebody there that's pliable, and that was Hammett, the Poe's leader, who was the brother of the brutal tyrant now in power.
And Hammett's wife and kids were still in Tripoli.
As hostage.
As hostage. And he didn't, as you say in your book, he didn't look like the kind of swashbuckling person that would be able to take over.
Larry, by the way, you read. I really appreciate reading the book. It's very, very rare to get this deep. It's exactly it. Hamid was sitting there with a few bodyguards. He thought he'd have a standing army ready to, did William Eaton, ready to poise and jump on Derna. Instead, he found a guy who was out of shape with no discernible leadership skills. So he's like, okay, I got to whip this guy into shape, got to get my own guys, hire some mercenaries, and motivate them to take the city of Derna. Now, to keep in mind, the same misperceptions between Christians and Muslims that exist in many corners today existed back then. They looked at Christians as basically subhumans, and that they thought that they were above them and they couldn't be trusted. And a lot of the Marines looked over and said, these guys want to stab us in the back. I'm afraid to not sleep with my gun. So he had to formulate some cohesive army while walking through a desert with nothing but the stars to guide him, which was just an impossible feat.
It was an amazing, amazing feat. I really would like to see this in film, too. Ken in Chicago has something for us. Hi, Ken. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good. Great show, guys. Could you talk about who the enemy was, how they were organized? Were these nation states? I doubt it. Were they city states? Were they clans controlled by a strongman leader?
Both. I mean, it's the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, which you're seeing when Turkey was usually the most powerful. And I'm not an Ottoman Empire expert, but these countries kind of went out on their own and under the umbrella of the Turks. And they basically could do their own thing, but these were oppressive dictators who basically kept their subjects in line, and they were a military lifestyle. And one thing we learn even today, that we think we beat these guys in a war because we destroy their army or a lot of their infrastructure. Mm-hmm. If they survive, they win. And this Tripoli leader was able to get him to the table, sign a peace deal, and free our guys. And we said, we won. But because he survived, he was able to trumpet that he stood up to a new Western power. So we had to go back and finish the job under Madison on the Second Barbary War, led by Stephen Decatur and the once jailed but then free William Bainbridge. And then we had to go down there and go for complete victory with a schooled, fortified navy from Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, who we were friends with by this time, and Tripoli. So strong men, many nation states, but doing a lot of their dirty work, these terrorists, better known as pirates.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And we're talking about the kind of money they were asking was a lot, even by today's standards in some ways, a lot of money.
Yeah, they were. And it was three times as much as they were asking from Spain, France, and Norway. And by the way, Jefferson did his homework. When he went into those negotiations, he knew what everybody else was paying. And he knew we were being extorted and was beside himself that Adams wanted to pay and recommended he pay. He understood, but he also said, we could go hire people, we can form a coalition, and we could decide, you know, hire some mercenaries to go pound these guys in the name of America, and then we would be able to get our ships passing without paying this fee to enable us to turn a profit. But instead, we wrote the checks. By the time Washington took over, 20% of our economy was going to these terrorists. So something had to change.
20%?
Yeah.
An amazing number. Bill in Madison called, and he wanted to make sure that listeners know the ground troops were Marines and not Navy SEALs.
No, but the operation that Stephen Decatur put underway were akin to today's Navy SEALs. They were a formation of special operators working under the cover of darkness. They were able to pull off that feat. But the Marines led the charge, absolutely.
And those were the first Marines, right?
Yes, and that's why they have so much pride, and that's why Presley O'Bannon is so legendary, and that's why in the Marine Museum in Virginia, you could see the sword that was given to him by Hamid for being the hero that took Derna, that still used the facsimile that are used today.
What was the attitude of our population, of our citizens here during this time?
Terrified. Terrified that they were coming to our shores. They were saying, why do we want this fight? Who are these people? But because the stories were written up and the letters from the prisoners were relayed to our newspapers in order to spur the population to push our leaders to pay the ransom, we were terrified that they were going to come into Boston and start taking our guys hostage, when really they were really relegated to the Mediterranean.
It's just an amazing, amazing thing. But Jefferson Do you think he did a good job of keeping the public, what should we say, informed about, or at least maybe placated by what he was doing and what was going on?
I think he did intentionally a low-profile job, because the more forward he could talk about this blockade and how much it was costing and how uncoordinated it was on its liftoff, how he did it without asking Congress, because they weren't in session back then. To get them in session was a titanic task. And then he got permission after he put them there. He didn't want a lot of attention. You know, you don't want to be the first one to violate the Constitution. And, you know, so he kind of kept it kind of low.
Oh, man. Well, the other battle that I thought was absolutely amazing was the attempt by our guys to get into the fort by blowing up a piece of the fort. And it didn't end well for a lot of the guys. But to talk about that part of it, set that stage and talk about it.
Well, I mean, basically there was a wall built up around the city of Derna. And we had certain guys who wanted to scale that wall and others wanted to blow it up. And believe it or not, as late as the 1950s, that wall was still in existence in that desert. There's pictures of it. You can find them online. You know, I was thinking about using it, but I wanted to keep everything consistent and not confuse everybody. Our guys that died during another secret operation to terrorize the pirates, the guys that died are buried in Libya. And a piece of that wall that we blew up in order to scale to get into Derna, it still exists in the desert, we believe, today. And there were pictures of it even back then. They kind of left it. They've been so war-scarred, they kind of left it. But it means a lot to us because it was our first land war.
And we and a lot of guys lost their lives trying to blow that that wall up.
Yes. And the Enterprise was the operation that actually blew up. There was an operation also at sea into the port of Tripoli where they put two ships. One ship carried some of our guys, you know, some of our elite fighters, and the other one carried nothing but explosives. And the goal was to bring this ship right to a pirate ship, jump out, light it up, jump out, swim to our ship, and get out. Unfortunately, something ignited that ship, and our guys were blown up, and they washed up on shore. And those are the guys that are even buried today, that is gravestones. And I believe as of maybe a year ago, their graves were still untouched, even though ISIS was in control of the area.
The first guy who was sort of led the group of ships, and I'm terrible on the names, and I have to apologize, but there was a mistake made with him because he was newly married, if I'm not mistaken, and he asked if he could take his wife along with him and child, I believe, and that had some. Probably in the end had some not such good impacts on his performance.
Absolutely. And, you know, he had his kids with him. He thought it was going to be a quick operation. Man, it wasn't. He was touring around with them. It was a bad message to send to the rest of the guys. It disturbed. By the way, she was not described as one of the most attractive women in the world. They were pretty brutal back then.
Yeah.
And I believe that was Captain Barron. And he was one of the people that was not taken. He did not take this mission seriously. And it just goes to show you, you know, sometimes in the Iraq War, we had good generals like General Sanchez and Abizaid, perhaps, but they were not right. Even though we thought they were right, the decisions were wrong. They said, let's just turn this thing over to the Iraqis and leave. What happened is we had to rotate generals. We had to get them in there. And the guys who were right were Odierno. The guys who were right were General Petraeus. The guys who were right was Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. The guys who were right, you know, was General McChrystal. And that by the time we got the right leadership in place, we had almost complete victory. That's the American story. We get it right after we try everything else. That was the story. We thought this guy was a good guy until we saw him in action.
Brian in Milwaukee emailed to ask, what type of research did you guys have to do to find out about this war?
To find out about the war, it was us sitting around after the success of George Washington's Secret Six. I had studied that since 1988. Not every day, but just fascinated that George Washington had this spy ring that no one knew about, that never got any glory or acclaim until the 1930s. No one even could confirm they existed. And I said, okay, I've been looking at this. This would be great. We'll be able to do something new. I was done. Then they asked, would I be interested in doing another? And I said, no. And they said, well, what are you interested in doing now? And I said, terror. You know, between Al-Qaeda and ISIS, I pretty much feel pretty good about my knowledge there. And, you know, the first time we dealt with that was with Jefferson. They did some research and said there's very few books that have been written recently and certainly no with any success. We think if you bring new information into it, we'd like you to do this book. And then we did a preliminary look into the Marine Museum, and I went to the Marine Historical Center in Virginia, and I went down there. Amtrak stops right there. And they told me all this information. They showed me newspaper articles from the day. They were so helpful. And then I went to the Marine Museum. I thought we could do this. And I thought we could bring information to it. We could make this even more palatable to the non-historian, to someone who just cares about America or wants to hear a true story. And that's pretty much how it came to be. 2 years later, we had the book done. And now it's out on paperback.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Mark in Oshkosh, let's turn to you next. Thanks, Mark, for calling.
Okay. I have not read the book, but I think I'll get a copy and read it. But I wrote a book a few years ago on another subject that touched on this topic. And my question is, in June of 1805, there was a ransom paid of $60,000 to free our hostages. And I'm wondering if the guest has found any records as to what that ransom was composed of. Probably would have been gold or silver coins or bars or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know the type of currency, but it's probably two things. It was probably not only the currency that they requested, but it was also gifts. Evidently, they not only wanted currency, they also wanted stuff. Whether it was a gold chair, whether it was flat-out gold, whether it was jewelry, something indigenous to our country. When they came to visit, they wanted stuff. When we came to them, they wanted stuff. And when we were so notoriously late with our payments and with the gifts, it made life for our ambassadors and diplomats brutal. Many times they were basically arrested and then freed because America was not fulfilling its promise. But that's a good question. I don't know how they paid. I'm sure there wasn't dollars, but how it was relayed to them, because our currency was not respected when we were first formed. And you're talking about a country that was only 20, 30 years old.
Yeah. Interesting. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. What are there any lessons in and you kind of touched on this, but are there lessons in of leadership, let's call it, in global geopolitics that you think Jefferson left behind for the next person who would take over as our commander in chief?
Yeah, well, him and Madison were so much on the same page. We're basically the same person, so much mutual respect between them. I think all research yields that direction. And when Madison was fighting the War of 1812, Jefferson was in constant communication. And when he saw Jefferson and was in on all the decisions to take on the Islamic extremists, the pirates of the day, and then when it was time to fight the War of 1812 and then reestablish order overseas, we sent a message in the War of 1812 that we'll take on the world's best and brashest in Britain and stand tall. With the Battle of New Orleans, we sent a great message. And then we said to everybody, we're willing to finish the job in the Barbary Wars, which were there also called. So we went back to Algeria when they started taking our guys again at the behest of Britain. They wanted to see us harassed on many levels. So we went back there, refused to pay, and then threatened them with annihilation if we didn't. We had a track record that Madison built on that we're willing to fight, and then we had a Navy with a track record that shows how effective we are. And when they saw the size of our Navy and our willingness to take on these ships, we won. Not only did we free our hostages, get our guys back, we freed the world's hostages. It prompted Pope Pius VII or the VI to come out and say America has done more for the case of Christianity in their short time than all of the European powers have done in all their time. So that was pretty noteworthy.
It's truly an amazing story. I think the implications of the Barbary enslavement Americans that Jefferson... He foresaw that when he sent warships to the North Africa coast, did he not?
Yeah, he did, which is pretty amazing, too. I've got turned on to a dissertation by Uma Abedin, key aide to Hillary Clinton's father, who is an Islamic professor here, I think at Harvard, and he wrote how Jefferson was wrong to take on these Islamic nations and that he could have negotiated our way out of it. How, what a small world it is. He'd said that in the 1970s. I don't see it that way, and most readers have not seen it that way. The historians I conferred with certainly didn't see it that way. But Jefferson did not trumpet this because, number one, he had the Jefferson, he had the Louisiana Purchase, you know, his father of the Declaration of Independence, governor of Virginia, first vice president, first president. You know, he had a lot going on that he had to be proud of. He couldn't really make sense of the significance of the Barbary Wars, but I think it really sent a message to the world that we are going to be an emerging power. The crazy thing was, is we weren't. Now we have trouble taking on our enemy, and we are. Can you imagine back then the courage it took knowing that we were so new?
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Brian. And I have a friend who's a Marine veteran, and I'm going to give him a copy of this on Veterans Day coming up on Friday of your book, because I'm sure he's going to enjoy reading it. Thank you so much for spending time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Now, I appreciate the research, the questions. If anybody wants it personalized for any type of an event or holiday, you go to briankilmeade.com. It goes to my bookstore, and then we can just send it out. But thanks so much. Appreciate it, Larry.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it very much. Brian Kilmeade, our guest, he is a co-author of the book Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, The Forgotten War That Changed American History. Coming up, we're going to be talking about another U.S. president, Ulysses S. Grant, the author of the new book American Ulysses, with us next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.